the Talmud says the beginning of words is the beginning of unavoidable transgression. Which is to say, the minute you start talking. And especially since this workshop, this class, whatever this is words about words and so forth. And this is a little bit like a blind date, and a blind date with an English teacher, of all things. I am an anachronism. I am the dodo bird of academia. I still believe in words. I just finished in this very room an interim class where we did, with a colleague, we had a class where they read some novels, read some short stories, and saw some films. Which do you think discussed better? The books they kept saying were hard, boring. One young woman wrote on her final paper, I don't see why they have written such dribble. It's D-R-I-B-B-L-E. which is part of the humor. I just ran across this in the Washington Post, January 21. It's a nice little piece called A Librarian's Lament, Books Are a Hard Sell. He says, among other things, many people in my line of work no longer have the title of librarian. They are called media and information specialists, or sometimes librarian technologists. The buzzword in the trade is information literacy, a misnomer, because what it's really about is mastering computer skills, not promoting a love of reading books. So I'm a bookasaurus. I come confessedly with that old-fashioned belief. My interim students did not always realize that their taste was not being consulted, but some attempt was being made to shape that taste. Why did they write all that dribble? I've been thinking about that sentence, that question, for the last few days. It also supports this. I ran across recently a study about vocabulary decline among 17-year-olds. Have you all seen this? Hear about this? Incredible numbers. From 1950 to the present, the average 17-year-old in the United States has gone from a vocabulary of roughly 25,000 words to a vocabulary of 10,000. Somewhere, we've been losing words. And of course, I ask them how important that is, and we have great conversations about whether or not it's a serious matter that we have fewer and fewer ways to say who we are and what we are. And I don't mean to be simplistic here. I know that the average 17-year-old today is much more sophisticated with images than, say, the average 17-year-old was in 1950. But it seems to me that along with losing words, we're also losing stories. An appreciation for narrative, an appreciation for metaphor. Robert Frost says, if you aren't at home in metaphor, you aren't at home anywhere. It's a dangerous place to be. And I would submit, sort of as a prologue to our conversation, that all of our issues, from consumerism to homelessness, from immigration to war, are impacted by our inability to say who we are and what we are impacted by our inability to read and tell our own stories. And of course, this business matters hugely to us because our whole faith, in many ways, stands on narrative, that powerful story at the center of everything for us. Increasingly in America, I would argue that we have one story. It's American Idol. And if you ask the average person about the Christmas story, the first image that pops into their mind, a movie about a kid who wants a BB gun for Christmas. Yeah. The premise behind this little story is that preach thing, and I don't know what we'll make of this, but the premise behind it is that we need to retrieve those stories that address us at these levels. We need those stories that clarify us. One of my favorite lines has been that one from Robert Frost, who says, every poem well writ begins in delight. Remember your little kid? Mary had a little lamb, you know. who knows what that means, but there's delight there. Every poem well written begins in delight, but ends, he says, in wisdom. And here's the line I love, a clarification of life. This notion, that story, that poetry will actually clarify for us who we are. Every year about this time, as the landscape begins to whiten, I remember that wonderful story that I first ran across in Ralph Waldo Emerson's journals about a Sunday morning when he was quite elderly by now. And he had this habit, he would often get up on Sundays and go to these little country churches and listen to some person preach that he'd never heard preached before. And on one Sunday, apparently he did that. He went out into the country a few miles from Concord, very snowy day, to hear this guy preach. And unfortunately, or fortunately, the pulpit, the podium, was placed rather too close to a window. Any of you who are preachers know this can be a problem. Yes? Teachers too. That's why we have the shades closed, I guess. Emerson recorded in the journal that night, he said the snow was falling outside, and he says, first I watched the preacher, and then I watched the snow. Then he says, I watched the preacher, then I watched the snow. Finally, he says, I decided to watch, feel this coming, the snow. Lovely sentence, he said, it at least was real. The preacher was, here's a great word, spectral. What do you mean? Preacher was spectral. Non-substantial. Ghost-like. What was he looking for? What are we all looking for? We go to church in a sermon. What are we listening for in a story? It seems to me we want honesty. We want a sense that somebody has engaged the real issue. We want stuff from the heart. We want passion. We want to be taught. And I believe the technical dimension matters as well. Shoddy is shoddy, whether it's in a Christian context or not. We want what John Gardner calls a shining performance. And ultimately, it seems to me that many of our books fail us in some of the same ways that Emerson's preacher failed him. It's the falseness that rankles. Walker Percy says, bad books lie. Good line to memorize. Bad books lie. And the lie they tell is a lie about the human condition. We are, it seems to me, creatures of the surface who need to be invited again and again to the depths. And I think we have to be finding those writers and those preachers who do that for us. We want sermons and books that lead us toward truth, that give us an accurate rendition of the human experience. Since I just gave you a bad example from that class I just taught, let me give you a better one. This is from a student's final paper. I came away from this class with a profound sense that these authors matter, that what they say is something I need to hear, and I need to hear it often, because like a man walking away from a mirror, I forget. These stories remind me of true things. They teach me about grace, that it's big and creative and weird. And my impulse is to say that they lead me toward salvation. I thought that was a pretty impressive sentence. Maybe it was in, I don't know, Hurlburt's Bible storybook that you first began to find those texts that read you. And working in this field of contemporary short stories, I often think about the parables. Remember those parables when you first began to run across? What was the definition you heard in Vacation Bible School?
Earthly story,
heavenly meaning. I love that. Earthly story, heavenly meaning. I mean, literally, of course, the word means to place beside. To place beside. It's a metaphor. It's to say, life is like this. And then you turn to those sad sometimes, funny sometimes, parables that have, it seems to me, you know, over and over again, a shocking dimension. The one talent guy gets ripped for playing it safe. I remember as a child that one about the people who go to work at all different times during the day and then they all get paid the same. The wastrel is welcomed home. The shepherd abandons 99 sheep to go look for one. Some guy tears up a house looking for a lost coin. A mustard seed becomes an image of faith. Who would have guessed? And I guess my simple premise in here today is that we need to discover, maybe rediscover those parables, and discover contemporary parables by writers of faith. Part of this class was simply to suggest some names to you, some names that you may have perhaps not heard of before. The minute you heard there was going to be a class, stories that preach, or faith and fiction, or whatever, what's the first name that you thought would be on the syllabus?
Garrison Keillor.
Garrison Keillor. That's interesting. I actually did a Garrison Keillor course with my interim class. Pontoon boat. Don't you love that pontoon boat there? The Lutheran ministers going down. No. Any others that you thought for sure would be on here?
Buechner O'Connor.
Buechner O'Connor. Yeah, I just did a book on Buechner. I'm supposed to show you this until you know, I'll go buy it. spent my whole life working on that book. Go buy it. Who was the other one I heard?
Buechner O'Connor.
I mean, she's the obvious one. One of the things I tried to do is leave all the obvious ones out. It's interesting, though, you still haven't other names?
Eudora Welty.
Eudora Welty would be an interesting choice.
Donald Miller.
Donald Miller.
Walker Percy.
Walker Percy, Catholic.
Andre DeBose.
DeBose.
Walter Wangren.
Okay, now you're getting a little closer. I mean, really, Wangren and Miller, where would we buy Wangren's books?
Christian books.
Yeah, and one of the things I like to touch on, at least, is this divide, this so-called divide between Christian book publishing and secular book publishing and Christian bookstores and da-da-da. And you will notice that I've left off. I mean, obviously, if you looked at any of these stories in this book, none of these writers would appear in the so-called Christian bookstore. They are not the obvious ones. Jenkins, LaHaye, Peretti, Jeanette Oak. Do you know Jeanette Oak? In my own independent, unsponsored, unpaid-for survey of church libraries in the United States. A choice of poems is a choice of lives, the rabbis say. And one of the things I wanted to suggest to you is I'm not so sure about some of our choices. Thus, these suggestions. Finally, Kafka says, writers make a stench. Writers speak a stench, I believe is the exact phrase. That is, they get our attention, not just reproducing what we see, but making us see. In dramatic ways. And I believe art, good art, like religion, is calling us to attentiveness, calling us to be present in our own lives. I love the line from Kafka who says, a book should bite and sting. One of my interim kids says, you know, I've been bitten and stung quite enough, thank you. A book should bite and sting. He says, the kind of books that make us happy, we could, if need be, write those ourselves. But what we must have are those books that distress us deeply, that come upon us like ill fortune, like the death of someone we love better than ourselves, like suicide. A book must be an ice axe to break the sea frozen inside us. Remarkable notion of what stories are supposed to do. That was too long for you. How about Ezra Pound? A book is a fire you hold in your hand. William Carlos Williams. It's difficult to get the news from poetry, but every day people are dying for want of what is found there. W.H. Auden, poetry is the clear expression of mixed feelings. One of the books that really has addressed this for me over the years is a book by John Gardner called On Moral Fiction. In that book, he says, the value of great fiction is not just that it entertains us or distracts us from our troubles, not just that it broadens our knowledge of people and places, but also that it helps us to know what we believe, reinforces those qualities that are noblest in us, leads us to feel uneasy about our faults and limitations. And I tried to find stories that I think accomplish that enormous task. There is much in contemporary fiction, to quote Henry Zylstra's wonderful little book, Testament of Vision, that gives us more to be Christian with. Isn't that a great line? Gives us more to be Christian with, helps us confront what we believe. Okay, I was only supposed to take 5 minutes. Sorry. The stories that you looked at. I originally put 6 stories in this book because I thought I had 2 hours, and it turns out I only have 1 hour, so I'm going to just pick a couple. My tendency is toward the southern stuff, Anybody from south of the Mason-Dixon here? A couple? Okay. It's been really fun to be a Calvin for 20 years. When I first came, I put a sign, Appalachian Study Center, on my door. Then after a while, it kind of stopped being funny. People started sending me email all the time with all the Southern jokes. You know, if you think Sherlock Holmes is a housing project in Biloxi, you must be a redneck, and all that stuff. If your mother's ever been involved in a fist fight down at the sporting event, you know those stories. But I did find it fascinating, this book I did a few years ago, a collection of interviews, and there's a new one of these coming out. I found myself, when I started looking for these writers who were interested in faith issues, but not Christian bookstore people, I found myself over and over again in Chapel Hill, in Mississippi, in Alabama. And I'm convinced that there is still a kind of what Flannery O'Connor calls Christ-hauntedness about the South. So some of the stories that I put in your booklet are clearly Southern. Happy Memories Club, how'd you like that? Who could stop reading after, I may be old, but I'm not dead? Very Southern story. And I will look at that Gatto story as well. The three stories I'd like to look at very quickly with you and just sort of talk through. Happy Memories Club. It seems to me a story about the stories we need. Also, one might add, about living with fortissimo. If Alice were to come in here today, how would she come in?
So there's a number of us that don't have.
Oh, you don't have them? Okay. Well, I'll talk about them. It's Alice Scully. Anybody read that one? Happy Members Club?
She would come in waving her cane or something.
Or in her little wheelchair?
Yeah, wheelchair.
Okay. It's a story about aging, among other things. Lee Smith, who wrote that story, was here at Calvin in 1996. She is a practicing person of faith. I interviewed her for publication a couple years ago. She says fascinating things. This, by the way, when you get around to reading this story, if you haven't already read it, Lee has read it twice at nursing homes and says she'll never do it again, and they hated it. It's an interesting story about aging. Another story I'd like to talk about a little bit is Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been? It's a story with, it seems to me, a very strong moral dimension. Joyce Carol Oates was here in 2004 and was one of the most prolific writers that I included in this little collection. One might say that story is about the wages of sin. And then the third story, if we have time, Welding with Children, a story about a prodigal coming home, overheard in a Walmart store. Tim Gatro, who was here also in 2004, tells me that he overheard this whole story, just went home and wrote it down. Overheard this whole story as he stood in one aisle listening to people talking in another aisle in a Walmart store. I don't know how true that is, but interesting. So let's look at them. Sounds like maybe we need to read a little bit. Find that Happy Memories Club. Who's got it? What page? What is it? 99. Thank you. I should have all you who have raised your hands as being south of the Mason-Dixon line do the reading, but I'll do my best. I may be old, but I'm not dead. Perhaps you are surprised to hear this. Who's the you? You, the reader. It's one of the very southern things about this story. That you can almost feel that hand creeping around your shoulder. She's going to pull you in. She wants you on her side. See how you feel about this. You may be surprised to learn that people like me are still capable of original ideas, intelligent insights, and intense feelings. People like me. Pretty soon you're going to figure out what she's talking about. Who?
The elderly.
The elderly. And here's the sentence where you start getting a little nervous. Passionate love affairs, for example, are not uncommon here. Where are we? We're in a retirement home. And immediately you went, oh, man. Right? And then, come on, tell the truth. Pacemakers cannot regulate the wild, unbridled yearnings of the heart. Man, here's a lovely sentence. You do not wish to know this, I imagine. She's on to us. Immediately we're put in that defensive posture. You don't want to know about this, right? We don't. This knowledge is probably upsetting to you, as it's upsetting to my sons, who do not want to hear, for instance, about my relationship with Dr. Solomon Marks, the historian. "Please, son, please, Mom," my son Alex said, rolling his eyes. "Come on, Mama," my son Johnny said. "Can't you maintain a little dignity here?" "Dignity," said Johnny. "He runs a chain of miniature golf courses." Cha-ching. Satire. "I've had enough dignity to last me for the rest of my life, thank you," I told Johnny. It's funny. It's a dramatic little story. Well, all I got to do is say retirement homes, and you think, what?
The waiting home for death.
Yeah, a place one goes to die. What?
I don't want to be there.
You don't want to be there. Many of you, the minute I say retirement homes, it smells. Right, right. I was driving not long ago. I remember passing a retirement home, and then a hospital, and then a graveyard. Right by side, I sort of imagine chutes. You know, and the whole thing kind of. Well, really, I mean, the whole thing sort of behind a big wall of some kind. You know, I mean, these retirement. What do we call these retirement homes? Other names?
Assisted
living.
Nursing homes.
Nursing homes. But we give them these really cool names like Timber Oaks or Raybrook or, come on, Evergreen.
Leisure Village.
Leisure Village. And Alice in this story, when you read this story, if you brought her out, is she onto that? She realizes that this is a place full of euphemisms. And among the things that's expected of them here is what?
Cheerfulness.
Cheerfulness?
Toe the line.
Toe the line.
Proper.
Go by the rules. What?
Proper.
Proper. Any more?
Helplessness.
Yeah, kind of helplessness, but kind of. Well, they expect us, she says at one point, they expect us to become children. Okay? They expect us to be. Come on. Retirement. I've started thinking about this lately. this whole thing about retirement. You see people driving down the highway with those bumpers on the back of their retirement vehicles saying things like what?
Spending
my children's inheritance. And so come on, the notion of retirement in the United States is what? What do you do when you retire?
Indulge yourself.
Yeah, you become frivolous.
Yeah.
You indulge yourself. We go to Arizona or Florida. There seems to be two states that have been providing for this. And they have Senior Olympics. Have you read about these Senior Olympic things? I've decided that everything when you retire ends in O. There's the Winnebago, there's Jell-O that you eat. And the Senior Olympics, they play Skip-Bo, Uno, and Bingo. And you look at it, you know. And Alice, that's one of the things going on in this story, it seems to me, is Alice's resistance of their stereotypes of her. That's a great little story, simply to think about stereotypes of aging and how we deal with aging in this country. Very serious story, it seems to be, finally. Though funny all the way through, but serious story about aging. Well, it turns out that she's having this relationship, as she calls it, with Dr. Solomon Marks. And what's his story?
Stroke.
Yes. And he's thus losing
his nouns.
His nouns, yeah. He's forgetting his nouns. He's losing his memory. Gradually. On Solomon's arm, if you look close, is a tattoo. Indicative of he was a Holocaust survivor. And this one little nurse. Remember that nurse? What's her name? Miss Rogers. Miss Rogers, the nurse. She thinks it's not such a bad thing that he's losing his memory after all. His memories aren't all that great. She, in fact, says it's a blessing, to which Alice responds in language that may have shocked you. "It's not a blessing, you ignorant bitch," she says. "Our memories are all we've got." And then she begins to tell, it seems to me, a very serious story about her own life, her own human experience. You find out what about her? Those of you who read the story quickly, what do you find out about Alice?
Grew up in a seaside home. Her mother was abandoned by her father. It was difficult financially at both times. She lived in a boarding house, cooked for the people. Mm-hmm. And her mother became more and more reclusive as years went by. And that's where my memory fades.
Well, that's good. That's good. Her father was suicide, I believe. Her mother kind of went insane. Her sister dies of ovarian cancer. I mean, what a sad story. She begins to tell you little bits and pieces about herself. One day, tooling down the hallway in her wheelchair, she comes across a sign that's been posted on the bulletin board announcing a writing club. And she thinks this is great. It's going to give her a chance to tell her story. So she gets together with some of the people there in the rest home and begins to read her story, some of which we just told you, sort of get a second installment where we find out that there in the boarding house, she met, do I remember? Let's give you a summary paragraph here. She says, this is about her mother. Gradually, as Mama retreated to her room, I took over the running of the boarding house and Mama's care as well. At 18, Rose, that's her sister, ran away with a fast-talking furniture salesman who had been boarding with us. They settled finally in Ohio and had three children, and her life was not glamorous in the least, though better than some, and we wrote to each other until her death of ovarian cancer at 39. This is first time Alice is reading to the writing club, the little group. She says, this is as far as I've gotten. You with us now? She's told a lot of her story, including the fact that she was married to a pharmacist named Harold. She was an English teacher. Do you remember why she loved being an English teacher? This part of the story I can't quite believe. Her favorite thing as an English teacher was diagramming sentences. She loved that sense of order. Okay, she's told this story, some of it funny, much of it sad, obviously. Okay, this is as far as I've gotten. I quit reading aloud and looked around the room. Joy Richter was ashen. Miss Alina Greer was mumbling to herself. And Shirley Lassiter was breathing heavily and fluttering her fingers at her throat. Sam Hofstetter stared fixedly at me with the oddest expression on his face, and Francis Mason wept openly, shaking with sobs. How'd your story play?
Shocking.
Here's the line. Alice, now just look what you've done. Meeting adjourned. Well, what did she do? Well, I heard it. She told the truth. She told the truth. How do we feel about that? What do we want to be told? Come on, go to any bookstore. Go to Barnes & Noble. What's right there? What are our bestsellers all about?
The good life, the sacrament
life. I read a great little book by Barbara Kingsolver called High Tide in Tucson, which has an essay about the era of the O.J. Simpson business. You were all alive then, right? O.J. Simpson trial. You know how many books came out of that? I have to watch it with my students now. Sorry. You know how many books came out of the O.J. Simpson trial? Guesses? 50. 50 books. Just over 50 books came out of the... What?
Including O.J.
Including O.J., which had a 500,000 first print run, by the way. It's interesting. That's right up there with Updike and Oates. But now it's in remainder, so... She commented on that. She said, if you had gone to the publisher and asked them, why did you give us an O.J. book, another O.J. book, the publisher would have said what?
Sales.
We're only... Come on, finish this famous sentence for me. Filmmaker said it. We're only giving the public what they want. Kingsolver says, using that same argument, a mother could give her child jelly beans for every meal. Using that same argument, doctors could prescribe opium for head colds. And then this lovely line, she says, it's too bad we don't have a Hippocratic oath for the people who furnish our minds. And I think Lee Smith is playing a little bit with that idea in this story. That we need those stories that tell us the truth. I'll leave it at that. I think this is a great story to develop a kind of sensitivity to the real lives of people who live in such places, who ride in such wheelchairs, and who have such fascinating ideas about their own memory. The other story, I'd like to look at quickly is the Joyce Carol story. What page is that on? What?
83.
This is one of those stories. I don't know how many of you have read it, how many of you are going to read it, but when you do read it, don't read it alone, and don't read it in the middle of the night. It's a, it's one of these stories that, sort of pulls you in, very realistic, about halfway through, and boom, veers off. And you think, what happened here? Let's see if we can tell the story very quickly. The story is about a young girl named Connie, who's how old?
15.
Her mind is full of, her mother says... Trashy daydreams. Trashy daydreams. That's what her mother says. Now, where would you meet Connie? Where would you find her? Right now, today, where could you go find her?
Drive-in.
At the drive-in. I heard it. The mall, right? Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, I taught this story one time a few years ago here at Calvin over in the building across the way. It was a summer school class. It was at the, I had this on the syllabus the last day of the class. And there was a young man who was sitting right about here who had been very quiet the whole semester, about 20 kids in the room, but he was very quiet, hadn't said much. And on the day we were going to do this story, I came walking in 5 minutes before class, and he was sitting here already with his book open, weeping, just weeping openly, not just a little bit. I mean, he was weeping. It was one of those great moments, and if you heard teachers, you go, oh boy, now what do I say? You know? So I come on over here to the podium, and the students all come in, and they all have to walk right past this guy. So, of course, everybody knows he's sitting here still just weeping and weeping. And finally, it's time to begin. And I look over at him, and I kind of go like this. And he goes, he points to the story. He said, this is my sister. Now, if I had really good sense, I would have said, class dismissed. That's the story, right? It's the story of somebody we know. A 15-year-old girl who gets her ideas about her life from where? Glossy magazines. She looks into mirrors to check her face to make sure her face looks like all their faces, everybody's face. She lies to her parents. You know, the title of the story, Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? Nobody really asks those questions in this story. They think she's going to the mall, but she's often sneaking off to be with boys, apparently. And one day, down at the Big Boy restaurant, she meets... That is the Big Boy, isn't it? With that little guy with the hammer. I mean, all of it's perfectly described. It's the Big Boy. I had a student once who wrote a paper about the Big Boy as God. I'm not really sure about that. But there is a really interesting... Maybe I should read that paragraph. There is a really interesting paragraph. Sometimes they did go shopping or to a movie, but sometimes they went across the highway, ducking fast across the busy road to a drive-in restaurant where the older kids hung out. Restaurant shaped like a big bottle, was squatter than a real bottle, kept a revolving figure of a grinning boy who held a hamburger aloft. One night in midsummer, they ran across, breathless with daring. Listen to this language now. Right away, someone leaned out a car window and invited them over. It was just a boy from high school. They didn't like it. It made them feel good to be able to ignore him. They went up through the maze of parked and cruising cars to the bright-lit, fly-infested restaurant, their faces pleased and expectant, as if they were entering a sacred building that loomed out of the night to give them what haven and blessing they yearned for. They sat at the counter and crossed their legs at the ankles, their thin shoulders rigid with excitement, and listened to the music that made everything so good. The music was always in the background, like music at a church service. It was something to depend on. Three references in one paragraph to the fact that these young girls go to this restaurant like we would go to, longing for some kind of blessing. So it's a story about longing. It's a story about teenagers. But somebody shows up at the restaurant this night. Who's he?
Eddie.
What?
Eddie.
Eddie and... I love this guy. Arnold Friend. A Friend. Who's quite a bit older, though, dressed to look like all of them look. And he sees Connie and he marks her. He says, you're one of mine. I'll just tell you, Joyce Carol Oates wrote this story in one evening. She's like that. She just cranks stuff out. She wrote this story in one night while listening to Bob Dylan's song, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, having read in the newspaper that evening of the first big serial murder case, probably United States history, in the early 60s. The Richard Rodriguez murder case is called the Pied Piper of Tucson. Some guy was going around Tucson dressed as a teenager, though he was in his 30s, and would pick up young girls and rape and murder and so forth. And this terrible story was just in the news. And I think it's clear, Joyce Carol admits it, that she was thinking about that story when she wrote this one. A friend will show up at Connie's house one Sunday afternoon when the family's all gone, and like the wolf at the door, begin to do what?
Tell her that they had to come in.
Or lure her out.
Okay, come in.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you catch Arnold Friend's car, anybody? There's some lovely stuff in this story that makes you feel like an English teacher when you can point it out. the Arnold Friend's car has numbers on it. It's 33, if I'm remembering this right, it's 33-1917. And somebody figured this out. I don't know who first figured this out. But if you count backwards, and how many books are there in the Old Testament? There's a crowd that would know the
answer. 39.
If you count backwards from 39 to 33, it's Judges, chapter 19, verse 17. I'll just read it to you from the King James Version. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the wayfarer in the open square of the city, and the old man said, "Where are you going? And from whence do you come?" Whoa. Smuggled right into the story. Right into the title of the story. It's this biblical reference. And it seems to me that Oates is really up to something with those questions. What kind of questions are those? Where are you going? Where have you been?
Isn't that what God said? Isn't God said that to Satan in the book of Job?
Oh, that's it. I never thought of that. Yeah, you've been out and about in the world and so forth. Yeah, that's really good. And you should write this up. You could probably become a famous literary scholar. This is in dramatic ways. I haven't said this yet, but Arnold Friend, who is this guy, Arnold Friend? Increasingly, who is he? You said it. Yes, he's described as shaggy. It looks like he doesn't really have feet. He's kind of wobbly in his boots. He knows things he's not supposed to know. He knows about people who are dead and so forth. Increasingly, he becomes a very ominous character. And Oates admits this, a kind of devilish character. Other things about that question, where are you going? Where have you been? Some of you have teenage children. It's a parental question. It's the kind of question you ask your 15-year-old. They don't have to fill in that blank. What else, though? I mean, it's the kind of question that in those occasional moments of our life, we sit on the edge of the bed. And so, it's a big question. And Oates' point seems to be that this young girl is not likely to ask those kind of questions.
They're kind of important questions.
You think? Yeah. Where am I going? Where have I been? What's this? It's got a meaning of my life.
Yeah.
Questions. And so a friend shows up at her house. A friend is listening to the same music that she's listening to. There's a whole lot in this little story about popular culture, about music. The story is dedicated to Bob Dylan. And my students recently had long conversations about what does that mean? Who's Bob Dylan? But it's kind of an initiation story. Connie is initiated into the consequences. The consequences of the way she's lived her life. We're told in the beginning paragraphs of the story that she has two looks. Can you guess what that means, whether you read the story or not? She has two looks. By the way, there's a movie version of this story that's called Smooth Talk, and they really get this in the movie.
The kind of postures of perceiving the world,
Well, how's she look when she's at home?
Angelic.
I mean, in the movie, she can do things. The minute she hits the door, she does some stuff with her clothing a little bit, and the lipstick and whole thing, and the language changes. And she's two people. And in Frostian terms, the way leads on to way here. There seems to be consequence. And Arnold Friend shows up at your door. She is MTV and popular magazines, popular music and malls, cool cars and appearances. She lives in this media world where everything is appearance. the key word, and Oz is very good with words here. She says that Connie's central value is being pretty. She doesn't say it's being beautiful. She says it's being pretty. Very carefully chosen word. And her relationship with parents. I love to talk about this with students. Connie's mom is described as keeping up a pretense of exasperation with her daughter. Do you know what that means, anybody? Thank you. I had a colleague here, Calvin, years ago. I remember him describing the day when he went to the mall with his son and discovered that his son had begun to walk five steps behind him every place they went. And he had his, and this little sort of game that we play in America, teenagers and parents and the whole thing. And yet, what Oz keeps coming back to is this, Arnold Friend knows this girl. And if Arnold Friend's the devil, then that becomes pretty scary stuff. He tells her finally, as he sits there outside her house, ultimately successfully luring her outside, that the place she thought she was going ain't there anymore. He rips her in some ways out of the safety of her childhood house. The boundaries are all changed. What Oz does in the story is sort of leaves it to your imagination what happens. Now, if you make a movie, of course, you have to decide. The movie makers decided to give the story a sort of psychological ending, that she was dreaming this. But I should tell you that Joyce Carol Oates' working title for this story was called Death and the Maiden. So it's clear that she saw it as a frightening story of consequence. That wonderfully ungrammatical verse, the wages of sin is death. And then one other story that I want to recommend to you. This is a story by a guy named Tim Gattro. Anybody hear Tim when he was here a couple years ago? Anybody read any Tim Gattro? This is his first collection of short stories called Same Place, Same Things. He's a Louisiana writer, serious practicing Catholic. When I ran across this book, the first thing that struck me was I don't think there's any American writer working today who's better with metaphor than this guy. He can rock you with the perfect metaphor. For example, there's a story here that has a description of a woman that says, she was a pretty woman in a dirt road kind of way. I beat that one, I dare you. The story you read is from this little volume called Welding with Children. And that's the story I want to talk about for a moment. But I should tell you about it. He has two novels. The first is not a great novel. This one, which just came out a couple summers ago, is, in my opinion, very strong. The Clearing, it's called. Still available, I think. New York Times bestseller. I read this book on my way to... you know Jan Caron? Yes? I was flying to Charlottesville, Virginia, to interview Jan Caron at her Antebellum mansion in Charlottesville. And my plane got stuck in Cincinnati. I had this book with me. I just picked it up. So on my way to Mitford, if you've read the Mitford story, I read The Clearing. And you talk about schizophrenia. I mean, Jan Caron's world, and I like Jan Caron. I could talk... suppose I could say some things about Jan Caron. But her Mitford stories, if you know those stories at all, are steeped in happiness. She wants to write novels about good people. And I think that is in itself quite a challenging thing to try to do. Gattro's, on the other hand, are steeped in misconnection, sadness, loss, what he calls in one short story, the intermittent hopes of defeated people. Now, which do you suppose we prefer? To get back to my opening point, we may prefer the sunny side of the street. Jan Caron has sold over 20 million copies of the Mitford books. But most of our lives don't keep us exclusively there. Beach reading, yeah, but life is not always a day at such a place. See any newspaper. So it strikes me that a story... This book has this great dedication. It says, "My thanks to several old men now dead who didn't know I was listening This guy's really good at paying attention. I recommend him to you. And this story, all you had to do was hear the title, Welding with Children. And you thought, what?
Possible.
What?
It's not possible.
It's not possible. And it turns out, of course, that it isn't. In that first really humorous, maybe we need to read a little bit. You guys look like you're, what page am I on?
55.
Again, listen to this language. You know almost immediately where you are. Tuesday was about typical. My four daughters, not one of them married, you understand, brought over their kids, one each, and explained to my wife how much fun she was going to have looking after them again. But Tuesday was her day to go to the casino. So guess who got to tend the four babies? All I got to do is read that, and you know you're where. Where?
In the South.
In the South. Oh, this comes hard. I'm getting ready to move to the South, I should tell you, to the Appalachians. And I'm not sure I'll be able to teach this story there. I mean, I've talked to Tim about this, and he comes very close to playing dangerously with some Southern stereotypes.
There's Louisiana,
though. Yeah, this is Louisiana.
Yeah. I interject something. Sure. I think, you know, sort of, that brings up a very sensitive point about the use of stories in preaching. Because I have found that the closer the story resembles the situation in the congregation, the less I feel able to use it. Because it is somebody's story, and I really, I mean, everybody's going to know it, and it's going to be painful. You're going to put the pain and the shame out there for everybody to. And sometimes you do it ignorantly, and then later on, you know, you can plead ignorance or whatever. But if you do it, I've been in the congregation for 12 years, so ignorance is not possible. I mean, I can't pretend. Yeah. So what are you going to do? Tell me what you're going to do.
There's almost no story. If there's not some, you know, some kid in that class that's going to say, that's my story at some level. With that Connie story that we just flew through, you know.
But would you have done it if you had known the kid and that his sister had been exactly the same situation and that he had sat crying in your office prior to your bringing the story into class?
I have to believe it was healthy for that young man to have that moment.
That's not the question.
No, well,
very evading question.
No. It seems to me that these writers, they give you one remove. You didn't write the story. I mean, are there Bible stories that you don't do?
That's a good
question. There's David and Bathsheba. I mean, you just avoid that story because you know that's it. I mean,
God told that story.
I don't know. The southernness of this thing, the whole Walmart dimension, you might be a redneck if story, bothers me a little bit. And I have talked to Tim extensively about that. And there are a lot of writers. Clyde Edgerton is one. Kay Gibbons is one. You may know a lot of these names, these Southern writers, who get a lot of laughs by playing with the trailer park stuff. On the other hand, it seems to me that finally, this is a story. Well, a moment ago I said something about our story has all become American Idol or whatever. Did you see that in this story? This story about a grandfather in a town called Gumwood, which is a small town, right? And the narrator will tell us that that's not necessarily a bad thing, that everybody knows your business, but everybody does in Gumwood. And one day he's taking his grandchildren on this day, all these babies that he's supposed to be taking care of, he takes them downtown and overhears a conversation about himself. Remember the line? Here comes Bruton in his bastard-mobile. The whole town knows about this family. The whole town knows about the disaster in this family. And what does he say? Do you remember the line that immediately follows that? He says, I felt as if someone had just told me, remember it? It's a great line. I felt as if someone had just told me my house had burned down. He has a moment of absolute shock at hearing that word, bastard-mobile. And so, he goes back home having decided to do what? Remember this part of the story? What's he decide he'll do?
No.
Well, before that, even.
Go to church.
Yeah, even before that, You're right about both of those.
Get the Bible out.
First thing he decides he's going to do is get out the Bible storybook and read him some stories. The students tend to love this. It's hilarious. He starts reading Bible stories, and the kids all...
Listen.
They start listening, but...
They're like their adventures.
Yeah, they confuse them with TV and movies. And you really get, I think, a nice rendition of pop culture. This story is also, it seems to me, full of wonderful satire about... Do you remember the narrator telling you about his college experience? Where he attended one class where the professor was always looking up. He thought he was blind for a long time. He attended one where he didn't understand a word the guy was saying. And he said he sent our papers back to Pakistan to be too graded or something. It was a math class where he didn't solve for X. And his favorite class, the professor dropped dead in the class. I mean, it's hilarious, but in the middle of it, you get the sense that this is not a bad guy. It's a good old guy who's not had a lot of breaks. And now he's come to some realization that his life is kind of a mess. He hasn't been much of a father. And now he's being asked to be a grandfather. A really, it seems to me, satirical take on the contemporary landscape that another writer in the book there, Doris Betts, refers to our contemporary popular culture as an open wound. And it seems to me Gattro's playing with some of that same stuff. You get this sense of decline, the kids confusing television with the Bible storybook. Elvis and O.J., it all sort of comes in here. And finally the narrator shouts at him. He says, "The Bible's not a movie!" And at one point, he goes down in the basement and...
Takes the fuse.
Takes the fuse. And when the kids try to turn on the TV, he says, "It's dead." The TV died. And he has this dream. Maybe we should read a little bit of that. He says, "I formed a little fantasy about gathering all these kids into my caprice and heading out northwest to start over, away from their mamas, TVs, mildew, their casino mad grandmother, and Louisiana in general." So he forms this idea that he'd like to do what?
Start over,
escape, get away from all this. I could get a job, raise them right, send them to college so they could own sawmills and run car dealerships. There's satire there too, of course. And then he realized what? Later on that same page, he says, "I realized we couldn't drive away from ourselves. We couldn't escape in the bastard mobile." So he goes down to, this is kind of a fascinating dimension story to me. He goes down to in the story, it's called the Tree of Knowledge. What do you make of that? Who's he meet down there? Remember the guy's name?
One of the town leaders.
Yeah, the guy's name is Fordlison, I believe. What kind of guy is he?
He owns the... His son owns the sawmill.
Yeah. One of the big shots. And one of the leaders.
And he raised his kids right.
Yeah.
Because part of that is that he's got guilt from not raising his daughters right.
Did you like this guy, Fordlison?
No.
Well, at first, no, but then he told the truth.
You say no? Talk about it.
Well, just because it seemed, again, that the successful... Like, my mother is a Southerner. And I've spent my share of time down there, and I kind of have something of a notion of that culture. So it's just very stratified cultures, you know. I mean, I've lived overseas where the top dogs can moralize to the down and under people.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's easy for you to talk. That's my impression for it.
No, I think Gattro does that on purpose. I mean, he gives you this figure that you don't particularly like. Flannery O'Connor, by the way, often does this in her stories. The person who turns everything upside down. This is usually somebody you don't like. Any of you read that Good Country People? Mm-hmm. That Manly Pointer guy? Now, there's a Christ figure. Huh? Well, here you got this Fordlison guy who's not a particularly likable character, who's self-righteous in some ways and condescends in some ways, but you got it right. He tells him changing is anything worth doing, he says, hurts like hell. And he tells them, maybe I'll take those kids to church. And then he tells them where to start. And that's my favorite part of the story. Where does he start?
He's gone.
Cleaning up the yard.
That's right. And again, there's this other stereotype of, you know, 14 rusted down vehicles out there in the around the trees. But the advice is clean up your yard, and he does so. He starts cleaning up his yard, and what does he put in the tree? A tire swing. And the story ends with one of the kids being dropped off. And you have a sense that the kid really will be safe there, really will be taken care of there. The narrator's wife, how she feel about all this? She stumbles across him when he's painting the back porch, and she says,
"I'm not coming."
Well, she tells him, "Be sure don't paint yourself in a corner." She also says, "It's about time." So I don't know. I love this little. It's a little story about conversion. I don't know if we believe this anymore. I guess we could talk about that if you like. Do we really believe that people can change? I hope so, because it's at the very core of the gospel. Can people change? This story about change, about possibility, sometimes made possible by tough words. I hurried through those stories. I encourage those of you who did not read them to look at those. I'm not going to take time to talk about the others too much. The one I hate leaving out the most is The Ugliest Pilgrim. Did anybody read that and you're really disappointed that we're not talking about it?
I loved it.
Isn't that an interesting story?
That was about the bus.
Right.
Oh, that was
That's been made into a Broadway play called Violet that actually toured the country. I saw it here in Grand Rapids. It was made into an Academy Award-winning short film, The Ugliest Pilgrim. It's a wonderful story if you haven't got a chance to look at it. It's a story about a young woman named Violet Carl who gets on a Greyhound bus to go to Tulsa to be healed of her ugliness. She has a big scar across her face created by a childhood accident. And it's a question, it's a story about miracle, the possibility of miracles and so forth. The writer of that story, Doris Best, is someone who I brought here to Calvin. She is a wonderful woman. She was chair of the English department in North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for years, is retired now. She wrote that story I suppose she still is. She's an elder in the Presbyterian Church. She grew up in the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church, which she describes as all the right people. I don't know if any ARPs in here, but she's a very ardent, practicing Christian. And I think that story is wonderful for your consideration. I threw a little Jewish story in there, a parable called Gimple the Fool. Which I told my students is about Hosea and Gomer. And they all said, "Who?" A nice little foray in Old Testament stories. It really has the Jewish flavor. And what's the other one I'm leaving out? Oh, yeah, I hate leaving that one out. Raymond Carver's short story, A Small Good Thing. Which in some ways is where all this whole idea began. I have a good friend who's a minister in Greenwich, Connecticut, and he calls me once every couple of weeks and says, "Well, you know any stories that'll preach?" That's where I sort of began to hear this phrase over and over again. And I ran across this story, Small Good Thing. A story about tragedy just coming from nowhere. Did you read that one? Mm-hmm. Scotty, what day is it?
It's
his birthday. On the way to school, he's hit by a car. Gradually absorbed in the atmosphere of the hospital, he dies. And these phone calls about the cake, that they've forgotten the cake, have you forgotten Scotty? And then in the end, I hate to spoil it. It's a marvelous encounter between the baker who's been making these phone calls and the despondent, despairing, tragedy-ridden family. All of these stories, in one way or another, have freight that you may find shocking, disturbing. So I point you back to Kafka. We need those stories that bite and sting. Well, these bite and sting. They don't leave you where you were before. And I think that's what great art does. Dribble, indeed. Thanks for being here. If you want to ask me anything, feel free to come on up, I'll be around for a while.